It's a pleasure to be back with you this morning. It's always good to see certain things that are the same and people who are the same. It's always good to see people who are different, who I don't recognize. I did have a slight cause for hesitation coming in the front door this morning. I noticed a brazier with burnt logs on it, and are you requiring burnt sacrifices to approach worship this morning? That is the case. Thank you. Good to know. My worst fears have been realized. We gave that up about 2,000 years ago in our church, but you'll catch up one of these days, no doubt. No, it is a pleasure to be here. I don't know who the idea of the pulpit exchange originated with, but of course, with the interruption of the summer and things just not working the way we hoped, it's a nice counterbalance, and I appreciate the fact that Titus is ministering out in our direction this morning, about 15 minutes out that way, out of town. I'd like to talk with you about what I've called a kind of a linkage through what I've also called the Abraham connection. And I just wanted to muse with you and have you reflect on this massive, massive unlimitedness of God, both in his very being, magisterial, beyond our imagination, really, but also that limitlessness, that infinitude, coming to touch on our lives with great extents of time, far beyond what we can imagine. I want to muse on that a little bit with you this morning. We're going to read a passage out of Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 to 8, which is the first of three occasions where God solidifies a covenant with Abraham. Same covenant, but different aspects come out in it. So the first is that. And then what I'm going to do is we're going to move all the way over to Acts chapter 3, where something else amazing still involving Abraham gets linked in with it, okay? That's the Abraham connection. And in all of that, I'd like to just muse with you on the infinity and the majesty and the massiveness of God himself. So, first from Genesis chapter 12. Now, the Lord said to Abram, he's not yet been name changed, it's coming. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you'll be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Hold on to that little piece there. So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. And Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people that they had acquired in Haran, and they set out to go to the land of Canaan. And when they came to the land of Canaan, Abram passed through the land to the place at Shechem, to the oak of Moreh. At that time, the Canaanites were still in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built there an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And from there he moved to the hill country on the east of Bethel and placed his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. Notice he has a possession, but he doesn't have a possession at the same time. Peter and John were going up to the temple at the hour of prayer, the ninth hour, mid-afternoon, in other words. And a man lame since birth was being carried, whom they laid daily at the gate of the temple that's called the Beautiful Gate, to ask alms of those entering the temple. And seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, he asked to receive alms. And Peter directed his gaze at him, as did John, and said, "Look at us." And he fixed his attention on them, expecting to receive something from them. But Peter said, I have no silver or gold. What I do have, I give to you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, rise up and walk. And he took him by the right hand and raised him up, and immediately his feet and ankles were made strong. And leaping up, he stood, began to walk, and he entered the temple with them, walking and leaping and praising the one who's and praising God. And all the people saw him walking and praising God and recognized him as the one who sat at the beautiful gate of the temple asking for alms. And they were filled with wonder and amazement at what had happened to him. And while he clung to Peter and John, all the people, utterly astounded, ran together to them in the portico called Solomon's. And when Peter saw it, he addressed the people, "Men of Israel, why do you wonder at this? Or why do you stare at us as though by our own power or piety we've made him walk? The God of..." And you know who the next guy is, even if you didn't have the text in front of you, right? "The God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered over and denied in the presence of Pilate when he decided to release him. And you denied the holy and the righteous one and asked for a murderer to be granted to you. And you killed the author of life, whom God raised from the dead. To this we are witnesses." It's God's word. We have in our day-to-day language a special little class of words. They're very familiar words. We all use them. And in one sense, we all know what they mean. Except... there's a certain ambiguity, because when we actually use them, we're not always clear exactly what it is to which they are pointing, even though we know what they mean. If you're lost here, bear with me, okay? They're little words like now, or there, or here, or later. We all know what these words mean. But when we actually use them sometimes, it's not really clear exactly what they're pointing to. Let me give you an example. If I say to you, "You know, we really have something good going on here." Does the "here" refer to this church? College Hill, Beaver Falls, Beaver County, Greater Pittsburgh, West PA, the United States, you know, the Northern Hemisphere, Earth, who knows? Yeah, unless I tell you something more about the context, you're not, you know the word "here," it's a very familiar word and you all use it, but what do I mean by it right at that point? It's unclear. Let me try one more on you. Pretend it's late in the week, maybe Friday or Saturday, and I say to you, "Hey, something's going on next Tuesday." I did that over this weekend we just had. Some of you are thinking Tuesday, November 17th, and some of you are thinking Tuesday, November 24th, when I say next Tuesday. It's unclear, right? I've used one of these little devices that's so familiar, and yet the particular reference is unclear. Now, you can consider this good news or bad news, because God uses these little devices as well and marks out so much of history. I'll just take a couple from the book of Revelation, all right? God says things like in the opening Revelation, "I am coming soon." Now, I think I know what "soon" means, except he said that 2,000 years ago, and we're still waiting. Okay. How about this that ends the book of Revelation? Jesus says, "I'm coming shortly." That was about 1,900 years ago that these things were said. And so the good news is we bear the image of God. The bad news is he too uses these devices in ways that sometimes we're left to hesitate. And I want you to just hesitate with me this morning and think about God's infamous sense of majesty, expanse, and time. All right? It's talked about in 2 Peter 3. It's a famous quote you all know, right? Beloved, don't let this fact escape your attention, that with the Lord a day is like 1,000 years. 1,000 years like a day. And I know you can say, well, that's a little bit of rhetoric, and but actually we're seeing this sometimes. This is exactly right. What God says is going to be imminent. It's imminent in His span of things, which is much greater than ours. The implications for understanding God, just taking in the majesty and the magnificence of God. This is a God who, according to Ephesians 1, at the foundation of the earth, at the beginning of time, when time hasn't really been invented yet, at least in the sense that we experience it, right? Says He puts certain things in order and is going to be spending this inexorable amount of time working these things out bit by bit. You realize there are things that God set about doing back then, whenever then is, right? We all know the word then, another one of those devices, back then. And He has been bringing them to pass along the way. And He's done more and more, and He's done some, especially through the life of Jesus, and more through the history of the church, and there are still things yet to be taking place, which He says He's doing quickly, and we're still waiting. So that's the nature of the linkages I'm looking at. You know, to take all this back there and all this ahead, we almost need one of those photographic fisheye lenses that takes the broad scope and panorama of what's out there and bends it together so we can bring it into one glimpse. That's what we're doing these next couple minutes here. So here is God with all sorts of declarations. This is what He wills. This is what He's bringing to pass. I'll mention a couple of negative as well as positive ones. This is the God who says to Adam and Eve, don't transgress, for in the day you eat of that stuff, that tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will surely die. And they do, and they don't die. Except that when you get to Genesis 5, and you have all the genealogy, well, they did die. And the next generation, and they died, and that goes on and on. They died and they died. This happens in positive ways as well. God says in dealing with the situation in the garden, the offspring of Eve will crush the head of the serpent, right? And He's done that in principle. More steps yet to take place. Moses makes a bronze serpent in the wilderness so the people who are bitten can look at it and be kept alive. And then 1400 years later, Jesus says, and I too will be lifted up, just like that. 1400 years span of time. Ooh. How about some of these? Bethlehem, the least of the towns, will become great. That took about, 500 to 700 years to become a reality, but it did. Isaiah, more than 700 years B.C., the virgin shall conceive and give birth to a child. 700 years later, promise delivered. Wow. This is an amazing span of time. God standing by His own word, and I like that phrase in Hebrews 6 that says, and because He can swear by none greater than Himself, He swears these are true. And you know, our natural inclination, we're all limited, finite people, right? When we have to either wait a very long time for something, right? Or the things get delayed and the circumstances seem to make it impossible, right? And yet they are. I know this is very paltry. This is only about 4 decades. But circa 1980-ish, 81, wanting children, not seeming to have children, I hope just maybe possibly we could adopt. I know somebody else who made that plan, right? And then this past week, the baptism of our 5th grandchild. That seemed like an impossibility to me just 4 decades ago. That's a small period of time. Here's God in these huge periods of time, these long linkages. Why so? Why so? It's the nature of a covenant, and I know the word covenant can be bantered around kind of like just a casual thing, or, well, it's the word to use when you're in Reformed circles, but significantly, covenant is a major piece, right? A covenant of any kind are serious promises and agreements with details going into them that formalize relationships between two or more parties. And they say, we take this seriously. And this is going to be the intention. These are going to be the intentions that we carry through. And we make promises, whether we or whoever, somebody else. We make these promises. We seal these promises. Here is God in Genesis 12, 15, 17, again and again and again, making solemn promises to Abraham that in his lifetime, I'm impressed by 40 years. I hope you are. Waiting four decades for something, that's a long time, right? Nothing compared to him. He waited a century for just the beginning of the realization of these promises. That's a long linkage, but there it is. And what does God say? Well, we've read it in the 12th chapter of Genesis, right? A number of things going on. What's he promised? Well, he's going to be given a great name. By the way, he does have a great name. And if you just survey the 15 million Jews around the world today, who's the father of your faith? They'll say, it's Abraham. They should be saying that. Great name. A great nation. Speaks to itself with those kinds of numbers. And the more that's going beyond that, we'll come back to that in a moment. You'll be a great blessing, both God's blessing on Abraham and then Abraham's conveying some of that to others. Lots going on. The land of Canaan, Abram never really gets to claim it. When he buries his wife, he has to buy at an exorbitant price some miserable little hole in the rock, a cave, so he can do the burial in a land that supposedly he owns, but just not yet fully. Interesting. God's opening these things up. As he moves about, special protection he'll be given by God, and his life is in danger. And sometimes he cuts to some shortcuts, but God's still protecting him with that. Biological offspring seems impossible. Hey, how many people do you know in their 90s are expecting a baby? Any takers here? I know the answer is zero, right? And yet, that's the position that God has him in, as God again and again and again says, this is what he wants. And it's not just that he wants it, but he determines it. He wills it. He brings these things to pass and then takes, well, a day, 1,000 years, whatever it is, this enormous expanse to make it real. These are amazing things to step into, right? From a promised son to a great name to being the father of the Jews, Abram gets just a taste of it. What a taste that is. So, what did Abram or Abraham learn? Think about it. What did he learn from his amazing life, which, by the way, gets well into his second century, which is amazing in and of itself? What did he learn? What can we learn? Romans 4 raises this question. What did Abram learn? What did he get out of all these experiences that he was a part of where he knows God's intentions are this way, and yet it does not seem possible from this point of view? What did he learn? Well, taking together actually a number of things that are said in Romans 4, this is the heart of it. Abram lived by faith. Now, I want to be inclusive here. In one sense, everybody lives by faith in something. You realize this? One of the false dichotomies of our age is to say religious people try and live by faith while scientific or normal or secular people live by the facts. Wrong. It's not that simple at all. Everybody's living by faith in something. Everybody. Whether it's things that they can see and touch and experience and gain first-hand acquaintance with using the natural senses, Whether it's faith in trusting people or trusting a society or trusting a government or whatever. I mean, people have faith in lots of things. Everybody lives by faith. We cannot prove everything in this world. No chance. Everybody lives by faith. We say, well, then what did Abram learn? I thought he lived by faith, right? Well, specifically, he lived by faith in God, convinced that God could do and would do what God insisted that he would do. Now, that's a hard kind of a faith to follow, I think. But that's the faith. That's what Abram learned. That's what Paul's telling us there. Now, let's get more specific. He learned that if he had faith in God, which is an admission, can you admit this? I cannot do for myself redemptively what needs to be done for me. Right? I have to have what Luther called that alien righteousness brought to me, or there is no way I can have any kind of peace with God. That's what Abram learned. And Abram learned that if he would trust God for that and throw himself on the mercy of God, God was pleased to give it. And the phrase is, and accounted it to him as righteousness. Wow, there we are. That's what Abram learned. And he learned to receive that by faith as an admission. I can't do it. God does it. And then he learns step by step by step to love God and walk with him. You know, the paradigm many human beings have, by the way, human beings too, is sometimes to think, if I love God enough, then he'll be good to me. We often work on that. Pharisees had that issue, but the Pharisee problem isn't a Jewish problem, it's a human problem. Abraham learned the opposite. Love God, trust God, but most importantly, get the reckoning as righteousness from God, and then I'll learn to love and trust him more. What's the message to Abraham? And out of all of that, Galatians 3 brings in more of this Abraham linkage, right? The message is that this is the gospel that Abraham's getting a taste of. It's the gospel of Jesus. Abraham has it thousands of years early. According to Galatians 3, Abraham has it. It's pointing specifically to Jesus. And it's not just for Abraham. This is something else Abraham's learning. It's going to go beyond his Jewish compatriots. Again, if I did a survey, I don't know enough backgrounds here, but I'm going to guess maybe none of us here has any kind of a Jewish connection. We're all evidence that what Abram saw and learned and experienced, we are the fulfillment or part of the fulfillment of that amazing thing, the gospel of Jesus to other than Jews. Whom did Abraham anticipate? I've kind of answered this already, but if you had any doubt, just listen to Jesus in John 8:56. Abraham rejoiced at the prospect of seeing my day, said Jesus. Imagine, 2,000 years, my day. It's all coming back to Jesus, that absolutely unique, fully divine, fully human individual of earth. No one like him anywhere else, all right? And let's bring in this whole time sense of God, because that fits in there as well. This is Romans chapter 5. At the right time, when we were still helpless, Christ died for the ungodly. At the right time. Here's God's sense of time wound into this Abraham connection. As my mother used to say, someone sometimes just jolly well takes their own time. And I might say that's 3:29. Friends, you and me right now, okay, you and I, if you belong to Christ, you are Abram's offspring. You are. You are. There are many Jews who are Abram's offspring, but not all. Not all. But even if you're not biologically related, you are still Abraham's offspring. What an interesting way for God not only to transcend time, but also culture and ethnicity. I was talking with a bartender on the shore of Lake Galilee back in December, maybe early January. And he loved Israel. We had a lively, wonderful talk that kind of spanned a number of days. His job, bartending in a dinner restaurant overlooking Lake Galilee. And I said to him, I said, I'm just curious. I said, what does it mean to you to be a Jew? He said, well, they're my people going back thousands of years. I said, do you mind if I ask? He's a very conversational fellow. I said, do you mind if I ask? Is it the religious piece? And he looks at me like I'm joking. He goes, no, there's no religion in here. He says, I think I believe in some kind of a God out there. It's no religious piece for him. It's his ethnic roots. And they're genuine ethnic groups going back 4,000 years to Abraham. And yet here's Paul saying to me, with not a shred of Jewish blood, and to you, perhaps not a shred of Jewish blood in you, if you belong to Christ, you are Abram's offspring. There's this wonderful transcendent linkage from Abraham. Well, really, from eternity past to Abraham. Abraham to Christ. Christ to you and me. And God taking his good time until the fullness of time, when he'll bring all of these things together and the full family of God joins in eternity in glory, freed from the breakages and the disappointments of this present world, when all things will be made new. That's the Abraham linkage. Lord, help us in that with eyes to see as much as we can see beyond our own purview of space and time, and for putting before us these, well, otherwise perplexing, and those of us who by faith are Abram's offspring, we kneel in heart, maybe in body as well, at the masterful plan of your greatness, time transcendence, infinite holiness, majesty. Lord, you are indeed a great God, and these things show that to us. In your name and in Jesus' name, we pray.